Welcome to our fifth shiur of the Pirkei Avos Locks and Learns, sponsored by Jake and Karen Abelevitz, in memory of Jake's beloved parents, Eliyahu ben Abba and Leah Bas Avram, and Karen's brother, Yoshua ben Shimon Dov. Ironically, for the second week in the row, I had some recording problems, which is even more ironic, since when I was in undergrad at YU, I was in charge of the recorders for YU Torah. Apparently, I have forgotten how to use them appropriately. So the first 10 minutes or so until I realized that the recording was off was not recorded, and I will do a brief recap of that and then jump in to the audio picking up in around 10 minutes or so. So to give a little bit of a background of what we're going to do for today, Rabbi Binyamin Lau, whose book we've been referring to quite a bit in terms of the historical background to the Mishnayos and Pirkei Avos, points out that we're transitioning here from Mishnah, we're talking about Mishnah 4, to another stage in the history timeline. The first stage was during the times of the men of the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, where we're transitioning from the world of Nevuah, of prophecy, to the Chachamim. And now we are in a different historical stage, starting from approximately the year 200 BCE, moving today probably a good 50 years into 150 BCE, and the period lasts a little bit longer. We'll save that for other Mishnayos. And the main point of this part two is that there's a political and religious fallout from the ascent of Greece, the Edicts of Antiochus, the wars, the Hasmonaim Wars, story of Hanukkah, and the rise and fall of the Hasmonaic, the state of the Hasmoneans. In rabbinic terminology, this stage was called the Zugot, the pairs, as we'll see that most of the Mishnayos here have two rabbis together, Zugot. The religious leadership moved away from the kahuna, as we've mentioned in previous weeks, because of the various corruption, and that's actually going to be essential to the background for today. There were different sects of Jews during the time. There were the Prushim, which we would probably recognize as closest to our classical type of rabbinic Judaism. The Tzedukim focused on religious worship in the Beis HaMikdash, and the Essenes, who were a separatist group. We don't really hear too much about them. Our sages this morning, Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan, did have run-ins with the Tzedukim, and there are some interesting takeaways, some interesting Gemaros that refer to this, but we're probably not going to, and I guess now that I know for sure, we will not cover that today. We will perhaps cover that in a separate week, or just leave it be for now. So we're covering today, somewhere between the years 200 BCE and 150 BCE, the Maccabean Revolt, which seems to be historically, these stages seem to live through them, 167 to 160 BCE. And before I go into the details of this historical background, I did want to recognize one of my rebbeim from Yeshiva Flatbush, Rabbi Salim Dweck, who I had a freshman year for Gemara in the year 2000. And then in 2003, 2004, I had him for junior and senior Jewish history. When I went to Israel in 2004, his family also made Aliyah, and tragically, Rabbi Dweck contracted some sort of viral infection and passed away, I believe it was October of that year. And as I was reading Rabbi Lau's summary of the historical background to the time period, I couldn't help but my mind kept going back to the classroom, fond memories of Rabbi Dweck teaching this material to us. So the story begins in around the 170s, where Antiochus Epiphanes wanted to impose Seleucid uniformity on all of the places that they had rule over, and Jason the priest, Yason, wanted to be the Kohen, so he bought the kahuna from Antiochus and turned Yerushalayim into a Greek city, a polis. And if you look at source number 2 from the second Maccabees, quote Rabbi Lau has in his book, "To such heights did the passion for adopting Greek customs develop and the fad for imitating foreign manners advance on account of the ever-growing wickedness of the no-priest Jason, that no longer were the priests interested in the service of the altar. despising the temple and neglecting the sacrifices, they would hasten to participate in the unlawful exercises of the palaestra. I assume I'm pronouncing that correctly, but not sure. It's a boxing ring. As soon as they heard the calls of the discus. So basically, the football game went on. They dropped the stuff that was going on, the korbanos and the Beis HaMikdash, and went to go watch the game, go to the Olympics, etc. So this was going on during this time period. In 171 BCE, Menelaus pays Antiochus 300 more coins, and he becomes priest over Jason. And then in 171 to 167, Menelaus paid off Antiochus with the kalim, the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash. Not everybody was a big fan of that. At the same time, around that time, Antiochus said, no more worshiping anything but Greek gods. And then on the 25th of Kislev in 167, he put an idol in the Beis HaMikdash, and then the revolt and the whole Hanukkah story that we are used to. I believe that leaves us to where we are in the recording. So I will put the next section of the recording onto this, and we're going to jump in, I believe, with source number 3. And now we're live. Okay, let's start again. Just kidding. Okay, we'll catch up. So picking up. What? Commercial break. So these sages that we're talking about are living in this time period. As we'll see, they lived through the revolt as well. And there's a later source which we may or may not get to today. I'll just point it to you. It's on the second half of the second side of the sheet. Source number 6 is where our sage Yossi ben Yoezer is confronted by his nephew. His nephew sort of went to the dark side and was in charge. Rabbi Lau puts this in the year 160. Where after the revolt, there was still another king that came up and remade all the decrees that the Jews can't follow all their laws, and there was like an after-revolt and all that stuff going on. It wasn't just a simple, everything's done. And then, so Yossi ben Yoezer's nephew was actually in charge of executing Yossi ben Yoezer. We'll get to that source hopefully either this week or perhaps next week, but I just want to point out that this is not an easy time for these sages to be living in. So let's look at source number 3. What?
Why did he kill the
Greek? Because he was Greek, or at least Hellenistic, and there was the decree by the king Demetrius, I believe, who said that you have to kill all of these sages. And he was in charge of that. So we'll see the source a little bit later. Okay, so look at source number 3, back on the first side of the page. So this is a rabbinic source. The Gemara in Shabbos says the following about our two people, and we'll read the Mishnah in a few minutes. Our two people from our Mishnah, the Tanya, the Brisa says, Yossi ben Yoezer, Ish Sreda, Yossi ben Yochanan, Ish Yerushalayim. So these two people, one from Sreda, one from Yerushalayim, Gazru, they decreed Tuma al Eretz Ha'amim, that the other countries around Israel are considered tame, impure, ritually impure, as well as Val Kli Zechuchis, that glassware was also considered impure. So what is this all about? What's the historical context to these two decrees? So if you look in source number 4, it's from Professor Louis Ginsberg, who is an academic scholar. He writes as follows. The decree on the impurity of the lands of the heathens was passed at a time when the Jews were beginning to leave the land, Eretz Yisrael, and going abroad in the wake of the edicts and destruction wreaked by the evil Antiochus. So people wanted to leave. They wanted to get out of there. So as a consequence, so now here's an easy way to de-incentivize that. I say that every place that you go to or that you're trying to run away to is impure, 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 impure. And that's trying to keep people stuck within, not a bad thing, within Eretz Yisrael. The second edict of the first pair is extremely interesting. And if the first one was a political ruse, the second one was an economic one. The leading artisans in the glasswork trade were the Canaanites living in Tyre and Sidon. And all glassware in the land of Israel came from them.
Importing these vessels triggered tremendous competition between local products and those produced abroad, and many preferred to use vessels that did not receive impurity rather than the clay and steel vessels produced in Israel, which required particular caution because of non-cleanliness. So the stuff that was in Israel, there was more problems with it in terms of the cleanliness things. And if you imported from outside, all the glass is less problems with purity and impurity. So because of that, people were just importing from the outside, and that was a problem for the local trade. So the edict of the impurity of glassware had the effect of reducing the competition. So these two decrees do have a historical background to them. This is at a time where there was some level of upheaval. People wanted to leave. People wanted to move out of Eretz Yisrael. And now we have two decrees to try to encourage people to stay here and to trade within your own population. If you flip now to just a little bit of historical background, if you flip now to page two, second side, source number five, let's look at the Mishnah, and then we'll see how Rabbi Lau extrapolates a further historical reading from the Mishnah, and then we'll go to a more classical rabbinic readings of the Mishnah.
Rabbi,
yeah.
East
Strada. East Strada is a place.
Right.
Where is it? I don't have a map, but I think it is. He says here it's Western Samaria, next to today's Beit Aryeh at the Ale Zahav site, which was established by Cherus veterans in memory of Eliza Begin. Sounds good. Okay, so this is the sort of the epicenter, this is the point that we're focusing on, this Mishnah, source number five. It's two Mishnayos together. We're going to focus today on the fourth, but I want to see what the fifth one is. Yossi ben Yoezer, East Sreid of Yossi ben Yochanan, East Yerushalayim. So these two sages, Kiblu Mehem, they accepted, they received the tradition from previous people, as we've seen, Antigonus, Anshe Knesset Gedolah, Shimon HaTzadik, etc. So Yossi ben Yoezer said three things, and Yossi ben Yochanan said three things. Yossi ben Yoezer, Omer, Yihi Beischa Beisvad L'Chachamim, let thy house be a house of meeting for the sages. Vevemis abek ba'afar aglehem. You should, Sansino here translates it, suffer thyselves to be covered by the dust of their feet. Misabek, to be attached. Be attached to the dust of their feet. Veve shosev et sama estivrei. I mean, you should drink their words with thirst. That's the fourth Mishnah. The fifth Mishnah is Yossi ben Yochanan's teaching. Yossi ben Yochanan, Ish Yerushalayim, Omer, Yehi Beischa Pasuach Lervacha, let thy house be wide open, V'yu Aniyim b'nei Beischa, and let the poor be members of thy household. And then the one that I want to stay away from for now, which we'll hopefully elaborate on next week, V'al Tar Besicha Me'isha, you should not speak too much to women. And there's more to that Mishnah, but again, we're going to focus on. Just let it go for now. We're going to deal with it. I know it has to be understood in context, but that's going to be hopefully next week's topic. Although I might be sick next week, I don't know. So we'll deal with it. Don't worry. There's lessons to be learned from it. So the question is, again, we're gonna look at what the lessons are from each one of these ideas. But I want to look at now the Rabbi Lau's reading back with historical background to how he understands these two opinions, these two understandings of the Mishnah. So now go to your photocopied page. This is taken from the Sages by Rabbi Lau. On the top, it should say Part 2. And on the top right, it should say Binyamin Lau. So your photocopy page. Landscape. We have extra ones here.
Anybody need landscape photocopy pages? They got a bunch.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so... All right, so now his words are actually, I mean, it's translated from his original Hebrew, but I think it's a nice way of putting it, so we're just going to read it inside. Right on the left-hand column, underneath where I sectioned that off, that's the quote from Louis Ginsberg. Now we're on the bottom left-hand column. Yeah, it starts the teachings of Yossi ben Uezer. So with all of the brief historical background that we put in, remember we're fighting against the Greeks here and their decrees against us. The teachings of Yossi ben Uezer and Yossi ben Yochanan represent a challenge to the leadership of that generation as well as to the Hellenism and edicts of the period. Yossi ben Uezer directs his energies inwards towards the house of study. Let your house be a gathering place for the sages. One's environment should be suffused with Torah, and one's home should be receptive to teachings of the sages. A house with a bookshelf boasting the entire works of Homer, in which the children's room features a video library of Greek mythology, and which has a fitness room in the basement, will not serve as a meeting place for the sages. The character of the house determines its affiliation. This was Yossi ben Uezer's way of confronting Hellenism. Sit amid the dust of their feet and drink in their words with thirst in order to elevate the standing of the Torah and the sages in the eyes of the people. So this is his way of confronting Hellenism. Internal, build your house with, you know, learning, sages, etc. He contrasts that with Yossi ben Yochanan. He says they're two opposing ways of dealing with Hellenism. So next paragraph, yet alongside him we have Yossi ben Yochanan of Yerushalayim, who stresses the imperative of tearing down the walls of the house. A house which becomes a fortress, albeit for Torah, will not be able to influence the wider community and will remain small and elitist. In Yossi ben Yochanan's eyes, this was not the time for raising barricades, and his teaching was therefore, let your house be open wide. A time of crisis requires an emphasis on the virtue of kindliness, on keeping an open house, and concern for the poor. In his teaching, the core of the Jewish home is kindness, and his requirement is that it be opened wide, and that the poor be included as members of the household. Another more literal interpretation is also worth mentioning. Let the poor people, poor be members of your household, can be read to mean, let the poor be members of your household staff. A house which is open to all requires a large service staff. These same poor people should be employed. We're actually going to deal with that next week. We're going to talk about the ethics of hiring and firing. Let's say you have somebody who you is more qualified, but you can support somebody who's less qualified, who needs the money more. So what decision do you make? What's better for your business or what's considered better charity? We're going to talk about that when we talk about his Mishnah in the second next week. And you look at footnote 8, Louis Finkelstein has a slightly different view of this, takes a different view of the differences between each one of the first pair. Yossi ben Uezer was the head of the Beis Din, of the more conservative party, consisting mainly of priests and the wealthy classes. His students, being primarily members of these families, were therefore educated to make their houses meeting place for the sages. A different path was adopted by Yossi ben Yochanan, from whom Beis Hillel developed a more open, not just talking about sages, but letting everybody, the aniyim, not just the elite into your house, but also people who you may not be able to learn any wisdom from, but maybe you instead are the role models for opening up your house. So Rabbi Lau takes these two Mishnayos and pins them as two different approaches to how to deal with Hellenism. Do we fight the Hellenism, the secularism that's going around us by encouraging to make our house more quote-unquote elitist, but with letting in the Chachamim, being a place where the sages are, can come to learn, to teach, etc.? Or do we open it up for everybody? So I think that's an important debate, and it's important to think about how that applies nowadays. I'm not going to connect all the dots for you, but it's something to think about and to consider. We're going to hold off on sources 6 and 7 for now. I'm just going to let you get a taste of where we're possibly going to go with that, I think, next week. Is sources 6 and 7 talk about, as I pointed out before, number 6 is Yossi ben Yoezer's confrontation with his nephew, and source number 7 is Yossi ben Yoezer's confrontation with his son. Apparently, his son also went to the dark side and became more Hellenist, and there was a confrontation between him and his son as well. So what I'm going to deal with next week as a part of our discussion is, and it's going to stem from the teachings in Pirkei Avos, is how do you balance your own either political, religious views that you want to communicate to the entire community? How do you balance that with family life? Right? Where does the line, is there a line, where do you put the line between how open your house is to everybody? I have sages in my house all the time, but what about my kids? I have poor people in the house all the time, but what am I doing with my family? So that's something we're going to sort of put a pin in and talk about for next week. So we're probably going to save these sages for, these pages and the sages as well. Let's now go to the outline, which is a different sheet, different piece of paper. This is a typed Microsoft Word document. So it's the third and final piece of paper that you have. If you need more copies, we have over here. You need a copy?
Yeah,
by my house. Okay, so what we're going to do now for the duration, unless we have time at the end, we'll come back to sources 6 and 7 as prep for next week. But what I want to do now is do a more classical rabbinic reading of these of the Mishnah. And I also want to highlight the somewhat controversial approach Rabbi Lau and that we have been taking and putting these teachings in historical context. You want to be a little bit careful here, because the idea of putting teachings into historical context doesn't mean that the teaching is only relevant for that time period, as I'm trying to encourage all of us to do, is to apply it to our time period as well. If you read more classical rabbinic commentaries on Pirkei Avos, you're not going to find that many people putting anything into historical context, because each saying is relevant now, is relevant yesterday, is relevant tomorrow, is relevant 1,000 years ago. It's a timeless message, and when you put it into historical context, there's a danger that we limit it and then don't apply it. And I want us to be careful that as we are putting it into historical context, I don't think that limits or says this is not relevant. I think all the more so, especially since a lot of the climate and context that the sages were going through at the time aren't that much different than what we go through nowadays. If anything, it highlights and gives more meaning to what their teachings are. Okay, so that's just a little bit of a caveat. The more classic reading that we're going to go through now is from the other book that I generally use. It's in my knapsack, the Masifta. I've mentioned it before. So it culls various different interpretations, and I summarize the ones that I wanted to point out for you.
So you,
It's called the Masifta. It's a Hebrew book. I'll show it to you later. It's in my knapsack. So let's go step by step. Here we're focusing on Mishnah 4 right now. That's Yossi Ben Yoezer's teaching. So the three things we're going to be covering is let thy house be a house of meeting for the sages, suffer thyself to be covered by the dust of their feet, and then drink their words with thirst. So starting with let thy house be a house of meeting for the sages, this is source in the outline, this is the one. And then 1A, the simple explanation of this is you should have sages in your house. You don't really need that much interpretation on that. You should open your house so that sages can come and be in it. The question is why? So why should I open my house for sages? It's not a crazy, I'm sure it's, like, it's not something you're saying, like, it doesn't make any sense. It makes sense. You should open your house to sages. But what's the deeper meaning behind this? So if you look in source number 1A, Roman numeral, big Roman numeral 1, the Rambam in Deos, we're just going straight. So if you get lost, we're just going straight. Rambam in Deos says, this is a direct translation in the English, it is a positive commandment to cleave unto the wise and their disciples in order to learn from their deeds. As it says, as you will cling to him, ledavka bo. So the Pasuk says we should cling to God. How do you cling to God? So our sages question the nature of this command, for is it possible for man to cling to the divine presence? They resolve the difficulty, explaining this commandment to mean, cleave unto the wise and their disciples. So the way that we connect to God is through connecting to the Talmidei Chachamim. And therefore, continuing, one should try to marry the daughter of a Torah sage, marry his daughter to a Torah sage, eat and drink with sages, do business on behalf of sages, and associate with them in all possible ways, as it says in Devarim, to cling to him. Similarly, and here the Rambam explicitly brings us to our Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Similarly, our sages have directed us, saying, sit in their dust of their feet and drink in their words thirstily. So we have a bib. This isn't just a nice idea. This is a mitzvah d'oraisa. Ledavka bo, the Rambam counts it as a mitzvah. It's a biblical mitzvah to associate and to cling and to try to learn from the sages. And the next point here, the Me'iri and the Teferet Yisrael say that, you know, if they're in your house, you get to learn Torah from them. But it's also not just about the knowledge. It's also about the character. It's about the actions. It's about gadol shimusho shel Torah yoser milimuda. So it's more important to see and to service a sage rather than to just learn information from a sage, because the service is where you learn the real ways of life. You learn how to live, not just by what they say, but what they do. Actions speak louder than words, etc. Now, some just as a methodological point, so we look through Pirkei Avos, we have dozens and dozens and dozens of sayings. And the question is, are these just independent sayings, or is there a connection between one and the other? So what you'll find some commentators try to do is connect one to the next, to the next, to the next. Sometimes that's easier to do than others, and sometimes you might just want to say it's easier to just say they're separate statements. But sometimes you get a nice idea that this Mishnah that we just learned is actually flowing from the previous Mishnah, an idea that we just learned about, you know, last week, if you will. And there's two sources here that I want to point out to you. The Magen Avos says that this Mishnah that is highlighting the emphasis of studying and bringing in Talmidei Chachamim into your house is a continuation of the concept of Shlosha Dvarim Olam HaMeid, that on three things the world rests. One of them is Torah, and this is the way to incorporate Torah into your life, have sages in your house. The Yados Ephraim says that it's actually a continuation not from two Mishnayos ago, which is the Shlosha Dvarim Mishnah, but it's rather a continuation from last week where we learned about Antigonos Ish Socho. How did Antigonos finish off his statement? You should have the fear of heaven upon you. If you look in the, I quoted the Hebrew here, it's a Gemara in Baba Kama. The Gemara has a fascinating drasha. It says that Shimon ha'amus ha'amsuni, or somebody, some say Nechemya ha'amsuni, used to say every time the word S, Aleph Tuf, is in the Torah, it's coming to teach us something. It's an extra word that's coming to teach us something. And he went through the entire Torah, found every single time it said the word S, and said, this is what it's teaching us. But he got stuck. Where did he get stuck? The pasuk says, "Es Hashem Elokecha Tireh." You should fear God. And the word S is there. And the question is, what is that S coming to include? If I should, I fear God. There's no extra, there's no added. That's the end of the story. Period. End of statement. So what is the S teaching me? So he gave up, right? He gave up and he says, this is a big musr, this is a big lesson for us when we, you know, you work hard and you try to prove a point and then you come to the end and there's that one little last thing that just like doesn't fit. So we try to fit it and we make an excuse or we leave it off our dissertation or whatever it is. You know, we pretend it doesn't exist. And he says, Amar lahem keshem shekabalti schar la drisha, kach kabalti schar la prisha. Just like I got reward for all of the work that I did, I'm also getting reward for giving up my thesis. My hypothesis is wrong and I'm giving up. Okay, so that's a big muster. That's his whole life's work. And there's one little teeny thing and it doesn't fit. I'm giving up. But Rabbi Akiva comes to save the day. Ad sheba Rabbi Akiva v'limed es Hashem Elokecha tira l'rabos talmidei chachamim. What does it mean you should fear God? It's coming to include that you should also fear talmidei chachamim. And as we spoke about last week, fear doesn't just mean, you know, doesn't mean fear that they're going to hurt you. That would be a bad thing. But it's awe, it's reverence. So Rabbi Akiva comes and says, Es Hashem Elokecha Tira, Rabos Talmidei Chachamim, according to Yados Ephraim, that's why this is jumping off of the last Mishnah. Last Mishnah ended off, you should have fear of God. Now we're continuing, you should also have this awe and reverence of Talmidei Chachamim.
Does it show how the S indicates
that? No, it means it's including something. The S itself doesn't have to... there's no inherent thing in the S. It's, we always...
It's
a nice fourth. Okay. Aleph to Tav, the whole thing's included. Includes your older brother. So when it says, Kabeda Savicha Vesimecha, what is the S coming to teach? It says to include that you're supposed to respect your elder siblings as well. Question... That's why he's Dorish them. Because since it has no meaning on its own, it's an extra added word. We could probably do without it. If you cut off all of those words, we'd be okay. So the fact that it's there teaches us something extra here to teach us to fear to have awe of Talmidei Chachamim. Okay? So that's in terms of that. Now moving forward, a few other ideas. If you look in B, the Sforno says, not that your house should be open to sages, because at the end of the day, it's not always so simple. You know, I could open my house. Doesn't mean they're going to come, right? So he rather says that it means that you should make your house where the sages are. So meaning you should hang out in the base medrash. You should be wherever the sages are congregating. That's where you should go and try to attend those meetings, if you will. If they let you in, I guess. The next one, the Magen Elokim, says that it's referring to financially and materially supporting sages. The Abarbanel has an interesting reading, which we'll get to next week. Your house here, he says, equals your mind. So your house should be a house, your mind should be a place for the sages, meaning that you shouldn't just rely on your own thought processes when studying, but you should listen to the methodologies and teaching of the sages as well. And then finally, Avram, the brother of the Gra, says your house should be filled with Sfarim. Again, this is, I think, a practical next step reading, because if you say it really means I have to have my house filled with sages, again, it's not going to happen for most of us. Right? Our house is just, no matter how much we want it to be open to the sages, every single house can't be open to the sages. So rather, what does it mean? Bring in lots of books. And this is a nice counterpoint to what Rabbi Lau said about, you know, having your bookshelf filled with, you know, Greek mythology and all that stuff. Our house should be filled with Sfarim. When we walk into our house, it should be recognizable that this is a place where we respect and honor both the Torah and Talmidei Chachamim, right? So maybe have a picture. I personally don't right now, but it's not a bad idea. Maybe I should. Have a picture of some sort of sage that you respect, that you honor, that you look up to, in addition to your pictures of your kids and your grandkids and etc. Our house should be recognizable as a place that that is a Torah-infused environment. Okay, next point here. So, and suffer thyself to be covered by the dust of their feet. The simple explanation is that really a continuation of the previous idea in a strong metaphoric term. So what does it mean, let the Chachamim into your house? So you gotta put yourself fully into it. You gotta really cling to them. If you tie it to Misabek, the dust of their feet, tie it to Ladav Kabo, maybe, Alpi Jersha, if you will, this sounds like. Maybe etymologically they're not similar, I don't know, we'll ask our etymological experts. But clinging to the sages, clinging to their feet, clinging to the dust of their feet, run after them to serve them. We flip the page. The Tiferes Yisrael has a nice idea. He says that when you invite, what does it mean, the dust? Why are we dealing with dust here? So you invite them, what's going to happen? They're going to get the house dirty, right? So there's going to be dust all over. They're going to bring in their boots, and it's going to be raining outside, and you're going to have to clean up after them, and you're going to have to, you know, besides that, you're going to have to make your house nice and neat for when they come, and we have to put away, you know, shove everything into the closet, and, you know, put away all those DVDs and everything, and, you know, and really make the house nice and clean and Torah-worthy. We're going to have to buy those Gedolim pictures, maybe buy a set of Sfarim that we can return, hide the television. Whatever it is. So it takes considerable prep time to allow the Chachamim to come into your house and then to clean up after them. So the idea here is get used to the dust. It's okay. You'll do a little bit of cleaning. You could put up with it in order. It's worth the time, if you will. Then finally, the last
thing that you should be humble enough to learn from them, because you're dust. You lower yourself, just a thought.
Yeah, no, so that could be involved, that we should act like dust in front of them, that we should listen to them, listen to their advice. Getting back to what Barbanel said, that don't be so, you know, your mind should be for Chachamim, that you shouldn't be so like, my mind is greater than them, and I know more than them, and I make my decisions on my own. You should have some humility involved there. We'll actually get to that in the next section as well. So maybe humility is a running theme. Good point. So the third part here is drink in their words with thirst. So what does it mean, drink in their words with thirst? Again, it seems to be on a simple level, just an extension of the metaphor of respecting and listening to Talmidei Chachamim, your commitment to serving them and to listening to them. The Maharal takes all three of these pieces and says that there are three impediments to us taking sages into our house. What are the three impediments? So number one is space. I don't have space for them. I'm going to have to, you know, put my kids in the basement and, you know, have seven people sleeping in one room so this guy gets a nice bed. So it's difficult. I don't have space for them. So as a counterpoint to that, that's why the Mishnah says, open up your house. Don't worry about space. Number two is that, again, it's dirty. They're going to have to clean up. You're going to have to prepare. Don't worry about the dust of their feet. And then finally, number three, what else are we afraid of if we allow sages into our house? They're going to critique us. They're going to give us mussar. It's like, you should be doing this a little bit better. You should be doing that a little bit better. Maybe whatever, whether it's on how we behave or whether maybe if it's even on our commitment to various halachic principles, they're going to critique us, and we're afraid of that, so we keep them away. And that's why the counterpoint to that is drink up their words with thirst. Listen to their mussar. Listen to their critique. The only way to grow is by listening to criticism.
Is there a counter to that, how sages should act when they come to your house?
Yes. What? How's that? Use forks and knives?
How should treat
Yes, I actually do think, I don't remember offhand, but I do think one of the comments did say that there is something about how the sages should come in when they go to the house. They should treat it, obviously, with respect. This Mishnah might not be directly referring to that, but I think that it's a fair point. There is a Norm, the point here is that we would hope is that they're embodying good midos. That's the idea. If they are not, then maybe you don't want them in your house. They're not the people you want to be learning from, you know? Okay, so the next C over here, 3C, the Rivash, says their words should be refreshing like a cold drink of water on a hot day. My take on this is that we should be looking at the metaphor here is that, you know, we have basic needs. What are our basic needs?
Food, water.
Food, water, shelter, right?
Books.
I don't know how books. I don't know how many other things get into that list. It's a good debate that I have with other psychologists at points in time. My perspective is that needs, real needs, are food, water, shelter. And where we get ourselves into problems is when we confuse our wants with needs. When we think we can't live without X, Y, or Z. I need this. And maybe even I need love. I need affection. I need to be validated. I need that new computer. Whatever it is, when we have all of these needs, which actually are not physiological needs, and then we don't get them, that creates a tremendous amount, or could create a lot of psychological disturbance. So I, in general, like to limit our amount of needs to the basic physical psychological needs. And when based on general semantic theory, when we use words like need, when we don't actually need them, our body reacts in a way that it's actually a need. So we get a physiological arousal, like I need it, and then I'm deprived of it, and our body reacts that way. So one of the things that I often work on with clients is changing needs to preferences, demands to preferences, based on REBT, Rational Motor Behavior Therapy by Albert Ellis. We'll talk about it in detail at some other point in time. But perhaps I'll go against my own basic general overview of how I like to look at needs versus preferences and say maybe the message of this Mishnah, at least on a spiritual level, is that Torah should be a spiritual need. And we should place it, at least on a spiritual level, at the same level as food, water, and shelter. This is something that I can't go. You know, the Gemara has different drushas. You can't go 3 days without water. You can't go 3 days without Torah. That's why we lane, the Gemara says, on Monday and Thursday, so we don't have a gap in our week of 3 days without Torah. So on some level, again, maybe on a spiritual level, we should look at Torah as water, as something that we need, at least, again, on a spiritual level. And what I'm going to close with today is this final source, which is a somewhat lengthy, but shouldn't take too long to go through. And this is going to tie in this Mishnah to help us prepare for Shavuot. So Rabbeinu Bachaye quotes this, in this context, the following medrash from Shir HaShirim Rabbah, which I bullet pointed into 11 different points. The main idea of this medrash is that Torah is compared to water, and there's psukim. I took out the psukim for the context because it gets a little complicated to understand what all the psukim are talking about. We're going to take it for granted now that the psukim teach everything that we need to teach. If we had more time, we would elaborate on how each pasuk actually teaches that, but for now, again, we're taking it as at face value, and we're gonna go through in a second after I take Shlomo's question. We're gonna go through all of these 11. There's actually more in the Medrash. I took some out just for brevity's sake, as how Torah is compared to water. Okay, so they're Roman numerals. Okay. We'll get to the Romans later. Okay, we got some time. Okay, so source F, Nimshalu Divrei Torah B'mayim. So Torah is compared to water, and the pasuk says, "Have a kol tzamei l'chu l'mayim." Everybody who's thirsty should walk to water. Should go to water. Yeshayahu, the Chazal tell us, is talking about the words of Torah. So now here's our comparisons. Ma mayim, Misof ha'olam ba'ad sofo. So water covers the vast, the world from the beginning to the end. We're covered in water. Kach Torah misof ha'olam ba'ad sofo. The Torah as well is from one end of the world to the other. It encompasses the entire world. Number two, ma mayim chayim le'olam. Water is eternal. Kach Torah chayim le'olam. Torah is eternal. Number three, ma... They didn't have to pay for water. Okay. They didn't have to pay for water, but there were more diseases and they died earlier because of it. So, number three. Ma mayim min hashamayim. So water comes from the heavens. Kach Torah min hashamayim. Torah as well as from heaven. Ma hamayim bekole kolos. So water has reference to it in terms of the kol, the voices, the sounds, shenemar, this one I quoted the pasuk, kol Hashem ala mayim, the voice of Hashem is on the water. Kach Torah bikolei kolos, the Torah as well was given with voices, shenemar, Shavuos related, vayi b'yom ha'shlishi, b'yos ha'boker, b'kolos ha'brakim. There were voices, there were sounds when it came to the giving of the Torah. Number five, ma hamayim meshivin ha'nefesh, water quenches the soul, kach restores the soul, kach Torah, Torah as well restores the soul, Torah Hashem Tamima, Meshivas Nafesh. Source number six, ma hamayim mitarim es ha'adam mituma, so water purifies us from impurity, kach Torah mitaheres hatame mitumaso, so to Torah purifies us from our own impurities. Number seven, mahamayim mitarim aguf, not only in terms of spirituality, water helps in terms of your actually bodily physical needs, referencing to what I mentioned a moment ago. Kach Torah mitaheres aguf. Torah itself is good for your body, not just for your soul, it's good for your body. It gives you energy, it gives you, it makes you healthier if you follow the ways of the Torah. Number eight, mahamayim yordin tipin tipin. Vinases nachalim nachalim. So water drips a little drip at a time. I think Rabbi Akiva, one drip, one drip, one drip. But it eventually goes into an entire, rivers and rivers. Kach Torah is a very important point. Adam lamad beis halachos hayom. You learn two things today. Ubeis lamachar, two things tomorrow. A mishnah here, a halacha there. Ad shenase kenachal nabe. Eventually, that becomes a rolling river. So a little bit here, a little bit there. It adds up. Mahamayim, number nine. Mahamayim, manichin makam gavoa. Getting back to your point before, water goes from high places, it's a picture of a mountain, and it goes down to the lower places. Vaholchim b'makam namuch. Goes down to the bottom. Kach Torah, maneches misha daito gavoha. It leaves people who are arrogant. Umidabekes b'misha daito namucha lov. And it sticks to, it attaches itself to people who are humble, who have humility. Number 10. Ma, and we'll reflect on this in a second. Ma mayim ein miskaimin bekli kesef izav. Similar idea. Water, you put water in a gold flask, in a silver flask. It's not gonna work well. It's not gonna taste good. Ella be yarud shebekilim. You gotta put it in a plastic bottle. That's how it tastes good. Plastic bottles. Except think about the environment and all that stuff. Kach Torah ein miskayemes ela b'misha osa atzmo kekli charis. We also have to put ourselves as a lowly vessel, if you will. Same message as humility. We shouldn't make ourselves as people who are gold and silver people, but rather bronze people is how we should make ourselves. And now to reflect on this point in 9 and 10, right? What's Har Sinai? Har Sinai is the smallest mountain. The reason why it got chosen, according to the Medrash, is because it was humble. It didn't say, pick me, pick me, pick me. And that's why it was chosen. So Shavuos, Matan Torah, this Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, humility, humility, humility. We need to know our place in the world. Finally, number 11, Ma Mayim, Ein Adam Gadol Mizbayish Lomar L'Katan Ashkeni Mayim. We have no embarrassment. There's no shame in asking somebody to pour me a drink, pour me a glass of water. Another lesson in humility. Kach Devrei Torah, Ein HaGadol Mizbayish Lomar L'Katan Lamdeni Perek Echad Davar Echad O Pasuk Echad. We should never be embarrassed to ask anybody whether we think they're high or lower. Maybe we shouldn't even be doing value judgments of people's statuses and abilities to know or not to know. We'll talk about that in 2 weeks from now. But 2 weeks from now is when's Professor Kohler coming? 3 weeks? 2 weeks.
18th
is 3 weeks. Yeah, Aaron Cole is coming in 3 weeks. Yeah, 3 weeks. So two, it said today? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not Professor Kohler. But I think he's coming in 3 weeks. So we'll talk about this point in 2 weeks. But the idea here is that we learn from everybody. Right? We learn from our students more than we learn from our teachers and more than we learn on ourselves. That's the way that Torah is, just like water. So just to sum up, we saw a little bit of historical context. We saw Rabbi Lau's take on these two differing views, according to Rabbi Lau, whether when we're confronted with Hellenism, secularism, whatever it is, from the outside forces, do we sort of put up our barricades and become more focused on the house being a place of just Torah, closing our doors, or do we open our doors to everybody? Then we saw these classical interpretations. Running theme is that we should respect our sages, we should learn from our sages, we should serve the sages when it's appropriate to help them with what they're doing, and humility was also a running theme throughout. Next week, as I mentioned, we're going to be focusing on Yossi ben Yochanan in more depth. So his statements of Yihyeh Beischa Pasuach L'Revacha, your house should be open, the poor should be members of your household, and maybe engage not in too much conversation with women. And we will focus on various bigger points, broader points of, again, ethical questions of, do you open up, do you hire somebody who's less qualified if they need the money more? Is that an ideal? How do you balance your, these opening up your house to chachamim, opening your house to poor people, with your own family life? We'll see how that's going to affect us as well. And I think there's a few other things I want to touch upon, but we'll save that for next week. I will take a few questions. If you do have to go, please do so quietly. We also have to bench. So we'll do one question, bench, and then more questions. Barry had his hands up first. That's from the Medrash in Shir HaShirim. Oh, that's from the Medrash in Shir HaShirim.
All these different things.
Yeah, all in the Medrash.
Okay.
Yes.
There's an interpretation of afar, not only as dust, but also as soil, dirt as the soil. So that it points to the responsibility we have to grow, that the words of the Chachamim should be planted within us and that we should grow. So it's not only humility on nivus, that we're like dust or dirt, but that we really have an interactive relationship.
Okay.
Awesome. Very nice, beautiful.
Okay, laser, we'll get one more in.
Yeah. You mentioned here two gezeiras. The length is a tomer. Outside is red. The other one is the glass is not to be used. But there was a third gezeira, the oil, shemen. And the people didn't adhere to nothing because they were canceled. Isn't this one?
This third gezeira. I don't know if that's in this context. I'd have to look into it to see what's going on. Okay, thank you guys. Chaim, are you still our resident Kohen?